Hello and welcome to Mystical and Mysteries, the podcast. Join your host, Olivia Dibert, as she talks about true crime with a psychic medium twist. She will be spotlighting missing persons, cold cases, and paranormal investigations, and featuring interviews with experts in their field, psychic medium roundtables, and covering any and every topic under the metaphysical umbrella. Now, let's get into today's episode.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mystical and Mysteries. I have a really fucking cool guest with me today. I like to call him Big Daddy. He prefers the title Lord and Master. Insert eye roll. You guys, this is my husband, Craig Dibert. So I am super excited to have him on. His background is this, and this is why I asked him to be here today. Former law enforcement, he has been on special operations. He's a sniper. His last title before he retired was detective. So he's got some good background. To say he's an expert in his field is just putting it mildly, and I'm super proud of him. So I just wanted to let you know that he is here to kind of give me insight on a case that I came across. As you guys know, April is the month for South Carolina. I'm telling you, it is the weirdest thing, because every time I pick a state to work on, there's something that makes a huge difference, or there's something that's connected to me in some weird way. So ironically, I will be going to South Carolina in April, and here I have these cases, and South Carolina was picked. So very, very cool. So Craigor, I am just going to tell you a little bit about this case. This is a cold case that I have that I did a reading for, and it happened like 30 years ago, but I wanted you on today because I had some questions when it came to police work. And I think it'd be really cool to get a police officer's point of view on a case, so that people who are not familiar with the job of law enforcement can get an inside maybe look of how things run.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, so this is the case of Alfonso Brown. It was midnight on Easter Sunday in 1992. He was shot. He was 14 years old. He was shot in the chest, and he was just one block away from his house. The investigators said that the shooter was near the corner of Horton and Jenkins Street. They found Alfonso lying in a nearby driveway covered in blood. The cold case investigator, she said she remembers the scene pretty clearly. The shooter was at least a block and a half away from the victim, and the only evidence that they have is, I guess they call it projectile, and I'm assuming they're talking about the bullet.
Normally, yeah, the projectile would be the actual bullet.
Okay, so does that mean that they have the bullet in their possession?
I would assume so.
Okay, so the investigators believe that Alfonso was the intended victim, but they would not talk about the possible motive because this case is still open. Throughout the years, I think that they've had about 6 or 7 suspects that people have given information on, and some have been eliminated by either an alibi, or they couldn't be eliminated at all. And so a lot of those people are still people of interest. When he was walking, there were 3 other people with him. So that tells me he was facing the shooter, right? If he's shot in the chest, and he was walking with 3 other people. I find that very interesting. And the other thing is, the investigators were saying, despite the numerous witnesses that were there on the scene, they all remain tight-lipped. So Rick Woldall, who is the cold case investigator in Greenville Police Department, he was quoted saying, somebody in the community does know what happened that night. Somebody knows who the shooter was. It's just a matter of us trying to put all the pieces together so that we can provide closure for the family. So, you know, there's not a lot of information to go by. Do you want me to ask you questions now, or do you want to hear my rating on this case first?
Sure. Why don't you just go ahead and go review the reading and then see where it goes from there.
Okay, that sounds good. So when I tapped into this whole situation, now remember, I just have a picture. I don't know anything about the case whatsoever. And I feel like this young man may have had some really hard life lessons at an early age. And honestly, I don't know what those life lessons are. I kept getting visions of school. His school popped into my head, and I could not pinpoint why I was getting that type of vision. But I just kept seeing like a school hallway. I did feel like this kid was deceased. I did feel like he was murdered by an older male. And I feel that there might be some kind of connection to the school. I don't want to get into my left brain and assume, but it kind of feels that way to me when it comes to my psychic ability. They feel connected. And I once I felt like I was in Alfonso, who was also known as Ace, I felt like I knew my murderer. This was not, I absolutely feel like I knew him. And honestly, I felt like there was could be like a family friend or someone that knows, even the family knows this guy. I feel like he could have possibly been like a quote unquote father figure. And he was in a position where I felt like he wore a uniform. And I'm talking about the murderer at this point. So I felt like the murderer had gray overalls, like a coverall. It's something that you would see like either with like a mechanic or a janitor. And that's, I'm just feeling more pulled to the janitor type of scenario. And I did see a name, like it's like a nameplate on the left breast of his uniform, but I could not see the name for whatever reason. And I kept seeing, if I was looking out a back window, and I don't know why I'm seeing this scene. I felt like this could have been Alfonso's house, but I felt like I'm looking out the window and I see trees, I see forest, a very small patch of it. Then I got glimpses of inside a home. It's a very small home. So I don't know if it's an apartment or townhouse, but I kind of saw something like that. And again, I don't know if this is Alfonso's house or if I'm picking up a location that is connected to the suspect. And I know you like it when I call them perps. But I did feel black male, 40-ish, possibly 40-ish at the time of the crime. And I'll explain myself why I said possibly. I felt like he was 6 foot. I did feel like I saw facial hair, possibly like a mustache and a beard. Larger build. I felt like he was on the bigger side, like even his neck looked big, and not necessarily fat, but stocky is what I would call him. Maybe a combination of the two. And I kept seeing the letters J and R, or I kind of kept wanting to say junior. I keep wanting to call someone junior. I also heard the word Mississippi. And I felt like I saw the perp in, again, the uniform. I just kept seeing the gray coveralls. And getting everything kind of in patches. And then here's the other weird patch of like a vision that I got. I felt like I saw him walking to a door. When I opened the door, I felt like I saw a staircase. So down in the basement, and for whatever reason, if I get visions like this, I know they're kind of relevant to the situation. I just don't always know how they're relevant. So I'm hoping if someone hears things, they'll be like, oh shit, that makes sense. So, but I did see a door. It led to the basement. And again, because I didn't know anything, I did feel like I was at a funeral. or like a gathering for him. So I knew his body had been found. And then I just started feeling an older female, an older to him, and crying. Like, you know how I get sometimes. My poor husband has to deal with my weirdness. But I started feeling super emotional. I started to cry. And I felt like this could have been like a mother or a grandmother figure. She was just so sad. And she thinks about the situation every day. And I do feel like they have their suspicions of what happened and who did it, but they don't know for sure. And I don't know if there's a lot of evidence at the crime scene. Now, here's the thing. At the time I didn't know where the body was found. But this kid, I felt like, was a really sweet kid. I feel like, he came from a family of a religious background. And then I saw him walking down the street, and it was kind of like, I call it a country setting because it's not like he was in the city at all. But it just popped in my head really quickly. And I did see a vision of a vehicle, and the vehicle looked like a 1980s type of sedan. I want to say that it's probably light in color, and it had like squarish headlights. And then for whatever reason, at the time I felt hit and run. Like I did damage and then I took off super quick. It was just, like I said, it was all coming up, all chopped up. It wasn't until I started reading about his case and I found out who he was, all his name and all that stuff. I saw a picture of his mother. And I was like, oh shit, that's the lady I saw. But the weird thing is she looked like she looks right now. I didn't see her at the time of the crime. Therefore, I will say this. It is very possible that the image I got of the perpetrator very well could be what he looks like now versus at the time of the crime, because I felt like he was in his 40s. I can't remember if I said that out loud, but I felt like he was in his 40s. And that would be about right. If this happened 30 years ago, they were in high school. It's very possible that the perpetrator could have been younger at the time of the crime. So I honestly cannot figure that part out. And so it makes me frustrated because as much as I try to sit with stuff, I can't always get it. I know sometimes when I get asked questions, it's like all of a sudden I just know the answer. But the reason why I wanted to bring you back here is because of that distance. They said that the perpetrator was probably about a block and a half away. And I just felt like this person had experience with handling a firearm. What do you think about that distance and that scenario?
Well, the idea that the shooter was a block and a half away, if my memory is correct, a block typically, and it certainly varies from city to city, is usually about a tenth of a mile. So that's a fairly long distance for a handgun shot. Not that it couldn't be done by someone who is experienced or that understands what they're doing. If it was a congested area or a city atmosphere, I think someone that had a rifle or a shotgun would have been pretty conspicuous and probably stood out to any kind of bystanders. And if the police are estimating that it was a block and a half away, I would assume that either someone made a statement stating that the suspect was there, or they have an ejected shot case from a bullet or a shotgun shell or a rifle casing that was found at that location, other than someone saying that they saw the shooter there or collecting evidence, meaning the spent casing. I don't know how they would have gotten that distance.
Well,
I'm
glad that you mentioned the type of gun, because I did feel like I had a rifle. I felt like when I was holding the gun myself, that it was long. So my left hand was extended out forward and my right hand was down by my side. So that's not a handgun, obviously, that position, right? So I do feel like this guy has some experience with guns, but we are talking about South Carolina, right? So hunting could be prevalent in the area. I don't know. I'm not too familiar with that area, are you?
No, not at all. For a long gun, for a rifle or a shotgun, that certainly a block and a half is not a long distance at all.
And the fact that there was three other people with this young man and he was the one that was shot right in the chest. I mean, right in the chest. For me, that just feels like it was someone with experience. Do you think that's safe for me to say?
I would think so. I'm assuming that it's not a random encounter either. If he was walking with several other people and that was only one, if there was only one shot heard or seen and only one person got shot and there were people on both sides, or he was walking with a group of people, I would assume that he was the intended target and that they were assuming they must have known he was coming. Most people don't just walk around on the street with a rifle. So it probably wasn't a crime of convenience. That would make me think that they knew that he was going to be on that street and that he was going to be coming that direction.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I felt like that's so weird. Okay. So I felt like he drove past the kids, and then I felt that he parked in an area that would have given him like quick getaway. From what I did pull up on maps, the Google Maps of what it looked like. And it's kind of like a country neighborhood, if you will. There's like a church on the corner where I think, what did I say? It was Horton and Jenkins. That's a church right there on that corner. There's, from whatever I could remember seeing, there's no sidewalks, there's no nothing. In the one corner, now we're talking about what, over 30 years ago now, but what it looked like today, very sparse trees, very sparse like bushes to hide in. So the fact that you said that they possibly knew he was going to be there, I find very interesting. When it comes to investigations, I know that a lot of people get really upset. I know families get really upset about, I guess, how police handle certain issues. What would keep the police from telling the family all the details?
Typically, a detective or the spokesperson for the law enforcement agency may not give out all relevant information to the case because it is specific enough that whenever they have suspects, whenever they investigate and when they conduct the interrogation or interview process with that possible suspect, those details being secret or not known to the public, if they can get that suspect to say something about those details or use those details in their statement, then they know for sure that that person was there, and it confirms that they were in the right place when the crime occurred. It may or may not mean that they're guilty or that they were the suspect, but it will help them determine that that person actually has credible information because they were able to give some of those details that the public is unaware of in their statement.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this. Isn't it true, though, if they release too much information, then it could also jeopardize the case?
Yes. If they give out information doesn't need to be distributed, then certainly people that may be people of interest, possible suspects, they may realize that they are on that list and they may make themselves unavailable, drive out of the area, get away, not make sure that they're not cooperating with the police, or they may know not to discuss those items or those pieces of information if the police pick them up for an interview. Certainly whenever they discuss pieces of evidence, it can certainly make the interview process more difficult if the possible suspects know as much information as the police does, or know what the police do know and what information and evidence they've collected.
Can that be thrown out by like the defense attorney?
No, a statement is a statement, and evidence collected is evidence collected. It just may make the interview or the interrogation process more difficult and make it more difficult to show that the suspect's statement is credible. Whenever they can match that statement and the facts given with things that were private or that they kept secret, that that makes it easier to prove that their statement is more credible.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this too, because I know what I picked up on this case, but I'm curious to get your opinion with your experience and having to deal with all this stuff. In your experience, why don't people tell on a suspect?
Probably the largest motivation is just fear. They don't want to be involved for fear of retaliation, retribution, someone showing up and threatening them or their family members. I'd say that that fear of violence is probably the number one reason that people don't get involved or don't make statements to the police.
Yeah, I felt like this guy is very well known in the community. Like, I think they know exactly who this person is. And I feel like they could identify him by his vehicle. So then what keeps from someone getting arrested? Could it be that they just, is it a lack of evidence?
Well, certainly to make an arrest for a crime, they have to have probable cause or reasonable suspicion. They have to have a good reason to detain someone, not detain, but arrest them. The police can detain someone to question them if they have probable cause to believe that a crime occurred and that they had something to do with the crime. But you can't arrest someone on that. You have to have more concrete evidence. You have to have something that links them to the actual crime. And if you don't have that evidence, if they arrest someone and they don't have the proper amount of evidence and they can't substantiate the arrest, then they can't keep them in custody. They have to let them go if they don't have enough to go to the prelim. So there's a lot of logistics and specific information that has to be followed in a specific way regarding the legal system, because everyone has their rights. Everyone's presumed innocent until they're proven guilty. So to take away someone's freedom, law enforcement has to have very good evidence that gives them the ability by law to take away that person's freedom and take them into custody.
And so here we're talking about 30 years later. What happens to all the evidence that's collected?
It really depends on the type of crime. For a homicide, to my knowledge, I was never a homicide detective, but I don't believe that they ever do anything with it. So it should all still be there. If they collected evidence, if they have statements, photographs, diagrams, et cetera, it should all still be there. Unless something happened. Normally homicides, they don't purge that evidence until the case is solved.
And isn't it true, if they have the bullet, would it be easy to match to the gun it came from?
Typically, yes, but not always. It kind of depends on the style of weapon. It depends on the ammunition. Was it factory bought or was it hand reloaded? Was it a smooth bore like a shotgun, or was it a rifled barrel? So there are a lot of particulars that could make it difficult. Also, the damage of the bullet itself, once it's fired and it strikes whether a person or a medium like brick or glass, it deforms. And so it may or may not be easy to match that to a specific weapon.
But I just felt it. I felt very strongly that this guy was used to weaponry, and I still feel like I'm being pulled, like this guy is older. And I just find that all very interesting. Like, why this kid was, I don't know. I feel a bit of two different motives. One being possibly drug related, and the other possibly being involved, or that there was something about a female. I'm wondering if it's just the combination of the two. And I really could not put it all together. It's just really interesting. What do you think when I tell you about this case?
What happens at a homicide scene, I think, is probably fairly consistent in that typically the police obviously collect as much evidence as they can. They photograph it. Usually they diagram it. They collect it in a specific way, preserve it in a specific way. And then typically they go and they talk to everyone. If you're in a city, probably they talk to everyone that they can find that lives or works or was in that area, on both sides of the street, up and down the street. They look at surveillance cameras. And this was quite a while ago, so I don't know how prevalent surveillance cameras were, probably zero at that time. But once you've done all of that, then it, if you don't have something that's concrete at that point, then the investigation probably really slows down, and it really comes down to the motivation of the detective that's working the case, as far as really just trying to determine those leads, follow up on anything that just doesn't seem right, or that just doesn't seem to match up with the circumstances. But if no one wants to make a statement and there's very little or no evidence that can be collected, that makes the investigation extremely difficult to continue with, because there really just is nowhere to go with it.
What would you say to families who may have been affected by someone who has been murdered in their family and this type of situation?
I think that really all they can really do is just be as cooperative as possible, and try to give as much information as possible. Any ideas, any leads should always be given to the investigators, but the follow-up leads that they don't have. So if no one making statements, if they can't collect evidence because it's not there, then there really is not a whole lot to do. They can't make those things up. So if you don't have evidence collected and you don't have specific statements from someone that you can follow up on, there's really not a whole lot of work that the investigators can do as far as follow-up.
But I would also say, you know, don't lose hope, because I feel like police officers kind of get a bad rap, that people feel like they're not doing everything they can for their families. I understand, like, I'm not saying all police departments, but I know that that does happen. I'm not an idiot. I know that that, you know, if they don't have a lot to go on, that's just kind of pushed aside. And I would normally say, and would you agree with me or not, that the smaller departments, it's just too much. There's so much that happens within the police department, responsibilities. Crime happens every day. I know I say that all the time, but isn't that, wouldn't that be true as well? The manpower.
Yeah, absolutely. A very small department has we don't have near the amount of resources that a large city or a larger department has. They may not have the number of people that can work the case or effectively get out and interview a lot of people. And consequently, then the more crime that continues to occur, the fresher crimes are the easier crimes to investigate. And so as time goes by, without any new leads or with any new evidence being collected, other crimes occur that smaller group of detectives and officers are constantly being constantly having work added to their desk, where they have to investigate more and more new crimes. And so those older crimes that have nothing new, they kind of probably fall by the wayside without having something new to investigate.
So is it a good thing that family is constantly calling the police and asking questions about what's going on? Does that help?
I don't think that it can hurt that family members are, you know, check in on a regular basis to see how things are going. I think that it kind of puts an unofficial pressure to keep working the case. The public can't really demand anything. Again, like I said, that police officers can only work on what they have to work on. So, but I don't think it can hurt to constantly check in. I think that that will help keep that case in the forefront of that investigator's mind, that there's still more work to be done there.
Right. What about small departments? Do they ask for help? Can they ask another department for help on certain crimes or certain cases?
Every area can be different, but typically really small departments usually have a memorandum of understanding with a larger overarching law enforcement agencies. We live here in Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania State Police is the overarching, they're the premier law enforcement agency in the state. So if you have a very small town, small police department in a town, maybe only one officer or a handful of officers, certainly if there's a murder, they're not equipped normally to handle that. So normally the larger agency would come in and take over the investigation, take over the statements, take over the investigation portion of it, take over the collection of evidence, just because the smaller department really doesn't have the resources available. They don't have a crime lab. They don't have technicians that can do those things. They don't have, probably many departments that are small don't even have an assigned detective. It's just the patrol officer who works that area does the follow-up. So depending on the severity of the crime, and the size of the agency and their resources, it's not unheard of for them to reach out to another agency or an overarching larger agency that they fall within their jurisdiction.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Are you ready?
Sure.
Does that make you sweat a little bit? So I'm going to ask you about gut feelings when it comes to being a police officer. So, you know, I think you're very intuitive. I find that police officers that are really good at their jobs, I feel that detectives are there for a reason. Like they're also got a bit of intuitive background. I feel like really good attorneys, they know how to read the room. They know how and when to say certain phrases. That's using their intuitiveness. Doctors that are extremely well at like surgery or trying to figure out, oh, this is what this is and not that. It's their intuitive being. Gut feelings. How often did you use your gut feeling while you're on the force?
I certainly don't have a number, but depending on the assignment and the person, yeah, I think that certainly can play a part of it. Some of it, I don't know that you can really draw the line between a gut feeling and just that inherent experience that you've dealt with something same or similar in the past, so you have a very good idea of how that's going to turn out or who is going to be involved. But certainly, I think that people that are really good at their job, they probably, it's a combination of that experience that they've had on the job and with people in general, and also that gut feeling that something's not right or I think this person's involved. And then it really comes down to the tenacity of that individual as to if they feel like someone's involved, but there's no evidence and they just have to really dig. They have to really just dive into that case, dive into that work and try to figure out how can they prove what they think occurred or what their intuition and what their experience is telling them occurred. So I think a lot of time it just comes down to how motivated is the investigator to try to make that happen.
We talk about shit all the time. Poor Craig listens to me babble about cases and my dreams and all the things that happen that helped me along the way. So I just want to say thank you for coming on and talking about this and getting a perspective from law enforcement. I think is imperative because I think that people automatically assume that police officers don't care. And where they would come up with that, I'm not too sure. But I think it's because they're emotionally invested, because they are either the victim's immediate family or best friends, or, you know, so emotions get a little high on that end. So I wanted to bring Craigor on here so you had an idea of some of the things that they do, the thought process, the procedures. I think all of that is really, really important to kind of shed a light on also so that we get a better understanding and how all this shit works when it comes to cases. And now, again, I'm not saying that all, you know, departments or investigators are peachy keen. I'm just saying that the majority of what happens is just like what we talked about today.
Yeah, I think that I think the overwhelming majority of police are doing it for the right reasons. They certainly are not doing it to become rich. I think that they're actually there, and their motivation every day is to try to help the public and help the area that they serve. That's part of their community as well. Most of them live wherever they work. So I think that they're truly trying to make a difference for the better. But it is their job. And typically, law enforcement work is not for people who are over emotional. They have to be objective in their process because they have to follow the law. It's not about what they feel. It's about what they can prove and how they do their job. So I think sometimes people see that lack of emotion and they feel like that officer really doesn't care what happened. That's not the case at all. They do care or they wouldn't be doing that job. It's just part of their personality that makes them a better police officer to stay calm and to be more objective about what their job is and how they do it.
I love that. I love that we had this conversation today. Thank you so much for coming on, Honey Bunny. And that's it, you guys. straight up from the old copper's mouth. And so happy that he's here. And thanks for listening. This was the story of Alphonso Brown. And I'm hoping that whatever evidence or from my readings that I have may help in some way. So if you happen to know the Brown family, if you happen to be from Greenville and you know about this case and some of this makes sense, you can always reach out to me. Also, I do really well with what we call monitoring, where I do a reading and then someone asks me questions and then I just can tap. I can keep tapping in. So feel free to ask me questions about this case. I will do my best to give you some answers or what I feel has happened. And, you know, of course, everything that I do is not something that holds up in a court of law. But sometimes I just feel like even if I'm giving detectives a nudge in the right direction, like, yeah, what you're thinking is good, you know, or it's correct. I know that sometimes I feel those shifts of energy that change and then I get super excited and I'll either reach out to a detective or I'll reach out to my husband and be like, would it be stupid if I reached out to this detective? Or, you know, so he helps me. I relay things to Craig so much that he does help me when it comes to how I need to interact with police officers and law enforcement. And so I do have a bit of a cheat with me at the house. And everything I do, again, is not, would never be held up in a court of law. Obviously, I do not solve cases. I said it from day one, police officers and law enforcement solve cases. They are the ones on the ground. They're the ones that have to collect the evidence and work their ass off in order to make it a good arrest or a good ending to a really tragic story. But with that being said, you guys, I am off like a dirty shirt. I will talk to you guys next week. Thanks, honey, for coming on today with me.
Sure. Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Mystical and Mysteries, the podcast. If you liked what you heard, please remember to hit like and subscribe. Have a question for Olivia or have a missing person that needs to be highlighted? Feel free to get in touch. You can reach her at theclaireconnection.com. Until next time, stay safe.